سمعت هالشباب يما الحرية عالباب يما طلعوا يهتفوا له شافوا البواريد يما قالوا اخوتنا هن ومش رح يضربونا سمعت هالشباب يما الحرية.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Aram Nagizian, who is a visiting fellow with the Ali Burke Chair of Strategy at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, where he specializes in security, politics, and military development in the Middle East, focusing on the Lebanese military, U.S. and Iranian strategic competition in the Levant, and challenges to civil-military relations in post-conflict and divided societies. Aram Nagizian has authored or co-authored a number of reports at CSIS, including Instability in Syria, Assessing the Risk of Military Intervention, U.S.-Iranian Strategic Competition, The Proxy Cold War in the Levant, and his books include Israel and Syria, The Military Balance, and The Prospects of War. Welcome to Background Briefing, Aram Nagizian.
Happy to be here.
And the Assad regime in Syria not only have total political power, it seems that they have also completely cornered the market on economic opportunity. Is that the case?
Well, this is the paradigm you have under Bashar. It was very different under Hafez. His father was much more keen on redistribution of capital, was much more keen on sustaining links with the rural periphery and the urban poor, which were the traditional base of the Ba'ath Party. Bashar has been far less successful and far less capable in terms of his leadership in managing those types of dynamics.
So is that to say that he's a beneficiary of the family kleptocracy, or is he just turning a blind eye?
It's a bit of both. This is not the kind of Assad structure that Hafez would have wanted. There was much more emphasis on centralized Ba'athi politics, much more emphasis on trying to shore up popular support. What Bashar has done is allow the emergence, and rather the flourishing of, a business community that isn't productive, that doesn't have any real positive effects on the broader macroeconomics of the country, with limited trickle-downs microeconomically. You have families and communities like the Makhloufs, for example, that essentially run key elements of the Syrian economy as gatekeepers. Because of that, you have a Assad structure that is deeply dependent on this symbiosis with these crony capitalists, and they're an integral part of the regime's survival strategy from a financial standpoint.
And of course, the Makhloufs, prominent amongst them, is Rami, Bashar al-Assad's cousin, who's supposedly worth about $5 billion, at least up until recently when the Syrian economy tanked.
That's correct. I mean, one of the core things we forget after a year of unrest is that the initial drivers in Syria were not that different from the drivers of unrest in other countries like Egypt and Libya and otherwise. Namely, that you have fundamental socioeconomic grievances, perceptions of corruption, perceptions of inequality, and poor governance. And that really hasn't changed a year later. It's just that we have forgotten that these are the core issues. And a lot of the initial anger at the popular level, before being leveled at Assad himself, were leveled at those who were synonymous with the crony capitalist system, like Rami Makhlouf.
And of course, another member of the family, the Makhloufs, is Hafez. Hafez is a prominent in the state security service. I must say, listening to what you're telling us here, Aram Nagizian, is you can't help feeling that's also analogies with Putin's Russia or KGB Incorporated. And there's no question that he's created a kind of form of crony capitalism, regulating the oligarchs. In this case, there are obviously far fewer in Syria. I just did an interview yesterday with a veteran war correspondent who covered the Chechen wars, particularly the second Chechen war, prosecuted by Putin. And he had developed survival skills there because every time he used a satellite phone, the Grad rockets would come in right on cue. And he actually briefed Mary Colvin, the woman who was just recently killed in Homs. As he was leaving, she was coming in, and he told her about how the Russians are tracking satellite phones and how to use them sparingly and take the batteries out. And when you use them, get the hell out of where you just were. Ironically, it doesn't seem like somehow she forgot that message. But the point of the interview was, and this fellow has an article currently at Foreign Policy, making the analogies between, or connections between, Russian strategies in Chechnya, particularly killing the messengers in terms of reporters, and Syrian strategies now being employed in Homs and other areas. So give us a sense of how deep this relationship is, aside from the kind of analogies that I'm drawing.
Well, and I can understand why an analogy with Russia is tempting. But one has to also bear in mind that you have similar parallels in terms of the militarization of social welfare or the rising up of basically non-productive sectors of the business elite to be part of the regime in places like Egypt. A lot of the grievances there were also driven by similar socioeconomic grievances against higher-ranking NDP members who also had significant financial investments. That also applies to the military, which has a lot riding on its prospects for managing a post-Mubarak Egypt. But in terms of the dynamic with the press, I mean, one of the challenges you have in a parallel with Russia is that the Russians are notorious for mismanaging freedom of expression and the press in terms of their own internal press structures with journalists. The problem you have in Syria is that you have a war zone where the reality of war reporting has come, you know, essentially full circle. People have to come to terms with that. When people go out to places like Syria, where you have no real government authority in places like Homs at the time, and certainly no sanction by the central government, these kinds of things will happen. This is a regime that is trying to control an already broken message about its authority, its authenticity. You have underlying social pressures from communities that still rely on Assad maintaining power that go well beyond the business crony elites like the Makhloufs. So you have a lot of elements that tie into this, some that don't really see eye to eye. Arguably, minorities like the Turkmens, the Christians of the country, don't necessarily like any of what's happening in the country and think that Assad and his cronies have mismanaged everything. That doesn't mean they can break rank. It goes well beyond this. There is a reality that there is crony capitalism taking place in places like Syria. There is a reality of mismanaging perception through the media, and there has been a targeting of the press. The bigger issues are, in the long term, tied into how the balance of power in the country will shape out. And things like freedom of expression and the press are relegated to second tier.
Again, I'm speaking with Aram Nagizian, who's a visiting fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He's also the author of Israel and Syria, The Military Balance and the Prospects of War. But not to belabor the Russian analogy, don't you think, though, Aram Nagizian, that there are some sort of almost atavistic Cold War reminiscences here, if you will? How much is this shaping up as a proxy war with the Russians making such a stand, along with the Chinese, for the Syrian regime in the United Nations, supplying them, and they have a major naval base there as well, and apparently the equipment that they're supplying is being used against the Syrian people?
Well, there certainly is a proxy battle taking place in Syria, but it's a bit more nuanced than the one you painted. In terms of the Russians and the Chinese, the problem we have now is that you have a much stronger rhetoric at the level of the international community in the West about the right to protect and humanitarian intervention writ large. The problem is that it's far more nuanced. You have players like the Russians and the Chinese who are thinking of things in much more classic balance of power terms, not really paying attention to things like humanitarian politics. The real proxy battle that's taking shape is a regional one. In the last 10 years or so, three key pillars of the inter-Arab order, namely Iraq, Egypt, and Syria, are either no longer relevant or no longer able to sustain their roles in shaping inter-Arab politics. So the Arab League has essentially become the Gulf Cooperation Council and everyone else. And the GCC states have found a unique opportunity not only to further their ambitions of consolidating the inter-Arab structure around them in ways that are conducive to trade, conducive to business ties, conducive to stability, but that also allow the Gulf states to confront Iranian influence indirectly, without having to contend with a potential hot war in the Gulf, competition at Hormuz, and, of course, a military option against nuclear program in Iran, which no one can assume is going to lead to stability in the Gulf. So what you have now is Syria as an arena where opposition forces can increasingly count on at least the rhetorical support of southern Gulf states. The Assad regime can count on Iran. And at the international level, you have the Chinese, the Russians, the United States. But arguably, the larger players are far more difficult in terms of how they maneuver, far slower in reacting to the shifts on the ground. Regional players are much more entangled in the fate of the region, much more entangled in how Syria plays out. So you have not only a two-level contest pitting local actors against regional players like Iran and Gulf states led by Saudi Arabia, you also have a third level with the international community pitting the West against Russia and China.
So in other words, you're saying that the analogy that I made of a kind of revival of the Cold War, a proxy war between Russia and the West, is not the real arena in this case. It is a proxy war, if you will, between Iran and the Saudis and the Gulf. And my understanding is that the Saudis, and particularly the Qataris, have already been supplying arms. The Qataris, I believe, have supplied a brigade that was trained in Libya. How much is the Free Syrian Army being aided, abetted, armed, funded, etc., by the Saudis and the Qataris?
Well, on the issue of the proxy war, you know, the idea that this could be a broader international one, that's still playing out. There's a very real risk that this could be a proper international proxy contest. The Russians, the Chinese, and the U.S. might look at this very differently a few months down the road. There are areas of commonality of interest. There's a common interest in minimizing Syrian spillover effects. So for now, we are focusing core on the regional cycle of unrest and how these players tie into that. The Gulf states have done more than just rhetoric. Whether or not they provided the kinds of support that we can expect if this becomes much hotter, that still remains to be seen. Certainly there are flows of weapons from any number of countries around Syria, critically among them from Iraq, Lebanon. Certainly Turkey, with its 900-kilometer border, has also been very, very cautious about how smuggling can affect instability along its frontier with Syria. So this is looking a lot like a protracted crisis. You have the Iranians who are funneling support for the Assad regime, and you have the southern Gulf states, which have been led initially by the Qataris at a rhetorical level, but we really also have seen the coming out of the Saudis in terms of coming to the front of this. The Saudis traditionally have been far more reluctant to lead from the front on issues like this. They've always preferred to either put on an international face or regional face or have other actors play the leading role while they provide support from the rear. We saw after the collapse of the Arab League effort through the mission structure that the Saudis essentially decided to come out and say, we are the lead player in the Gulf on this. It doesn't mean that Qatar is out of the equation. It just means that a lot of this is now being driven by Saudi. So we are looking at a protracted regional crisis. I wouldn't be surprised if months from now you still have this playing out. In many ways, it isn't that different from Lebanon or Iraq. These are arenas for competition. The core problem with Syria is that it's the regional nexus for all things linked to instability along sectarian lines, proximity to Israel, proximity to other states that have their own internal divisions, like Lebanon and Iraq. And of course, the fact that the Turks are so concerned is always tied to the Kurdish question and the potential of instability of a rather large minority at home.
So, Aram Nagizian, how can we distinguish then between official support at the state level and that's coordinated? For example, the Saudis, Qataris, are they coordinating with the Turks? If the Turks are worried about informal smuggling going on, which you've alluded to, I would have thought that there is some kind of coordination. There's also a border with Jordan, and obviously, Iraq is run by the Shia, but in the area bordering on Syria is the Anbar Sunni area. That creates probably internal problems for that rather unstable government. I'm just trying to get a sense of, because it seems to me, in the case of the United States, and Hillary Clinton's alluded to this, that the U.S. is not directly involved, but to some extent maybe is turning a blind eye to those who are.
Well, one has to look at the ring states around Syria and then factor in what the Free Syrian Army is and how that plays into their calculus about coordinating assistance. Jordan is under increasing pressure from within, from Islamist politicians and parties that have been asking the monarchy to play a more positive role and a more aggressive role in terms of getting involved in Syria. And this has very much less to do with Syria and much more to do with mobilizing any kind of opportunity to contest the monarchy. So you have these internal pressures. In the case of Iraq, yes, Sunnis and Shiites are essentially divided against each other. You have a Sunni community that feels that they need to play their part in supporting the majority Sunni opposition forces in the country. You certainly have Islamists in Iraq who are keen to support their brethren in Syria as well. And of course, while the Shiites of Iraq have always had this rocky relationship with the Assad family, it's still a case of the enemy of my enemy is my friend. The dynamics here are such that the Shiites of Iraq will largely bandwagon with Iran. They face a much more critical threat from having another Sunni power on their border than having to manage a problematic but relatively predictable from a regional standpoint, Alawite leadership. And we saw with Lebanon that there's always a risk of instability. You have Sunni-Shiite tension, and that's something that we've seen rise over the last 5 years. But more recently, you've seen an upturn and spike in Alawite-Sunni tension in the north of the country. And this is before you have any real spillover effects. If things were to truly get out of hand, peripheral states like these are likely to become far less stable, far less predictable. And the Turks have also been very reticent about what to do about Syria for the next reason, which is that they look at the opposition structure, they look at the regime, and a lot of the assumptions that the international community and regional actors made a few months ago, two among them critically, that first of all, the Assads would be embattled and would be in a much weaker position than they are now, and second, that the opposition would be able to get its act together, be far more cohesive, and have some kind of a structure or a mailing address for assistance. Neither of those two has really played out. The Assad regime, with its security apparatus, has proven far more resilient than anyone expected. And the opposition forces continue to remain divided against each other, cellular in their structure, and with very little cohesion in terms of the armed effort against the Assad regime. And there is no unity about whether this is supposed to be a defensive or an offensive structure. So this is becoming far more complicated than anyone expected. There are real risks of radicalization. And as the conflict metastasizes, it's not clear to me exactly how regional states can effectively support opposition forces in a cohesive fashion. It's far more likely that, like in Lebanon, and in many ways like in Libya now, you'll have militias that can be co-opted, that can be espoused for particular types of support by regional states. And if this cycle continues, and if you still have an environment where the Assad regime cannot exert sufficient control, there is no reason to expect regional states will not play this proxy game for the long term.
So just in closing then, Aram Nagezian, given the way that the Syrian regime now has taken Homs and apparently it's taking on the Free Syrian Army piecemeal, not all at once, but it seems to be effectively rolling them up. And you're saying they're already divided and cellular to begin with. It's not unreasonable then to assume that the Assads are going to deal a fairly strong blow to this nascent Free Syrian Army. So are you suggesting then that we'll just have a prolonged guerrilla war after this? There won't be a decisive military victory, or one way or the other?
Well, it's very easy to look at 1 year of unrest and say that things are going to wrap up in a way that it'll be decisive. The problem is that we saw in the last cycle of unrest in Syria, in the late 70s through the 82, we're talking about a six-year period. Now, mind you, that 6 years without mass media, without the internet, and without satellite television, things have moved much quicker, much faster, and attention has come on Syria in ways that it couldn't have in the context of the Cold War. What we're looking at now is a protracted crisis where you have attrition on both sides. You're going to see a regime that's going to do everything it can to roll up as much of the opposition as it possibly can, and will take advantage of the fact that they are so divided. Does this mean that Assad's survival is guaranteed? By no measure. There's every reason to expect that economic and social pressures can take their toll on their own. The reality, though, is that because this is a proxy battle, any settlement of what happens in Syria in the long term will have much more to do with the balance of power in the country and much less to do with whether or not Assad himself actually survives in power. You're looking at a Syria that, if it continues to deteriorate, will be a proxy battleground between what remains of the Alawite-controlled structure, where you will see a dissected Syria, where elements of the security forces that don't have a post-Assad future will rally, And you will see essentially the emergence of something like Somalia and the Levant. And that has all kinds of risks. Now, one of the reasons why actors like the United States have been reluctant to escalate this beyond a small fire under the Syrian pot is because of those risks. You have a very significant proliferation risk, whether it's in terms of shoulder-mounted anti-air missiles, anti-tank missiles, and, of course, chemical and biological systems. You have significant holdings across the country. And, frankly, without boots on the ground and boots on the ground that are reliable, it's very difficult to imagine how those systems will be secured. So it's a case of the international community weighing very carefully its international wants versus its international needs. It wants to see a change in Syria. It wants to see democracy and the Assads removed. But there is a need for some kind of modicum of predictability. And I know it's a lot to ask for given the high death toll, but the reality is that there are too many countries close by that are too critical to U.S. and international interests from the West, such as Jordan, such as Israel, Turkey, and of course countries like Iraq and Lebanon, to not factor them in effectively.
Well, I thank you very much for that rather sobering analysis and gives us quite a bit to think about. I thank you again, Aram Nagezian.
Pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Aram Nagezian. He's a visiting fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He's the author of a number of papers at CSIS, including Instability in Syria, Assessing the Risks of Military Intervention, U.S.-Iranian Strategic Competition, the Proxy Cold War in the Levant, and his books include Israel and Syria, The Military Balance, and The Prospects of War. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking with a biographer of Vladimir Putin to get a sense of how his victory is going to be greeted in the West.